Chapter 62. No penitence and no confessional, no priest ordains it, yet they are forced to sit amid deep ashes of their vanished years. Imagine a rambling, patchy house, the best part built of gray stone, and red tiled, a round tower jutting at one of the corners, the mellow darkness of its conical roof surmounted by a weathercock making an agreeable object either amidst the gleams and greens of summer, or the low-hanging clouds and snowy branches of winter. The ground shady with spreading trees. A great tree flourishing on one side, backward some Scotch firs on a broken bank, where the roots hung naked, and beyond, a rookery. On the other side a pool overhung with bushes, where the waterfowl fluttered and screamed. All around, a vast meadow which might be called a park, bordered by an old plantation, and guarded by stone ledges which looked like little prisons. Outside the gate the country, once entirely rural and lovely, now black with coal mines, was chiefly peopled by men and brethren with candles stuck in their hats, and with a diabolic complexion which laid them peculiarly open to suspicion in the eyes of the children at Gadsmere, Mrs. Glasher's four beautiful children, who had dwelt there for about 3 years. Now, in November, when the flower beds were empty, the trees leafless, and the pool blackly shivering, one might have said that the place was somberly in keeping with the black roads and black mounds which seemed to put the district in mourning, except when the children were playing on the gravel with the dogs for their companions. But Mrs. Glasher, under her present circumstances, liked Gadsmere as well as she would have liked any other abode. The complete seclusion of the place, which the unattractiveness of the country secured, was exactly to her taste. When she drove her two ponies with a wagonette full of children, there were no gentry in carriages to be met, only men of business in gigs. At church there were no eyes she cared to avoid, for the curate's wife and the curate himself were either ignorant of anything to her disadvantage, or ignored it. To them she was simply a widow lady, the tenant of Gadsmere, and the name of Grandcourt was of little interest in that district compared with the names of Fletcher and Gawcombe, the lessees of the collieries. It was full 10 years since the elopement of an Irish officer's beautiful wife with young Grandcourt, and a consequent duel, where the bullets wounded the air only, had made some little noise. Most of those who remembered the affair now wondered what had become of that Mrs. Glasher, whose beauty and brilliance I had made her rather conspicuous to them in foreign places, where she was known to be living with young Grandcourt. That he should have disentangled himself from that connection seemed only natural and desirable. As to her, it was thought that a woman who was understood to have forsaken her child along with her husband had probably sunk lower. Grandcourt had of course got weary of her. He was much given to the pursuit of women. But a man in his position would by this time desire to make a suitable marriage with the fair young daughter of a noble house. No one talked of Mrs. Glasher now, any more than they talked of the victim in a trial for manslaughter 10 years before. She was a lost vessel, after whom nobody would send out an expedition of search. But Grandcourt was seen in harbor with his colors flying, registered as seaworthy as ever. Yet, in fact, Grandcourt had never disentangled himself from Mrs. Glasher. His passion for her had been the strongest and most lasting he had ever known, and though it was now as dead as the music of a cracked flute, it had left a certain dull disposedness, which, on the death of her husband 3 years before, had prompted in him a vacillating notion of marrying her, in accordance with the understanding often expressed between them during the days of his first ardor. At that early time Grandcourt would willingly have paid for the freedom to be won by a divorce, but the husband would not oblige him, not wanting to be married again himself, and not wishing to have his domestic habits printed in evidence. The altered poise which the years had brought in Mrs. Glasher was just the reverse. At first she was comparatively careless about the possibility of marriage. it was enough that as he had escaped from a disagreeable husband and found a sort of bliss with a lover who had completely fascinated her, young, handsome, amorous, and living in the best style, with equipage and conversation of the kind to be expected in young men of fortune who have seen everything. She was an impassioned, vivacious woman, fond of adoration, exasperated by 5 years of marital rudeness, and the sense of release was so strong upon her that it stilled anxiety for more than she actually enjoyed. An equivocal position was of no importance to her then, as he had no envy for the honors of a dull, disregarded wife. The one spot which spoiled her vision of her new pleasant world was the sense that she left her 3-year-old boy, who died 2 years afterward, and whose first tone saying amour attained a difference from those of the children that came after. But now the years had brought many changes besides those in the contour of her cheek and throat, and that Grandcourt should marry her had become her dominant desire. The equivocal position which as he had not minded about for herself was now telling upon her through her children, whom she loved with a devotion charged with the added passion of atonement. As he had no repentance except in this direction. If Grandcourt married her, the children would be none the worse off for what had passed. They would see their mother in a dignified position, and they would be at no disadvantage with the world. Her son could be made his father's heir. It was the yearning for this result which gave the supreme importance to Grandcourt's feeling for her. Her love for him had long resolved itself into anxiety that he should give her the unique, permanent claim of a wife, and she expected no other happiness in marriage than the satisfaction of her maternal love and pride, including her pride for herself in the presence of her children. For the sake of that result, she was prepared even with a tragic firmness to endure anything quietly in marriage, and as he had acuteness enough to cherish Grandcourt's flickering purpose negatively by not molesting him with passionate appeals and with scene-making. In her, as in everyone else who wanted anything of him, his incalculable turns and his tendency to harden under beseeching had created a reasonable dread. A slow discovery, of which no presentiment had been given in the bearing of a youthful lover with a fine line of face and the softest manners. But reticence had necessarily cost something to this impassioned woman, and she was the bitterer for it. There is no quailing, even that forced on the helpless and injured, which has not an ugly obverse. The withheld sting was gathering venom. She was absolutely dependent on Grandcourt. For though he had been always liberal in expenses for her, he had kept everything voluntary on his part, and with the goal of marriage before her, she would ask for nothing less. He had said that he would never settle anything except by will, and when she was thinking of alternatives for the future, it often occurred to her that, even if she did not become Grandcourt's wife, he might never have a son who would have a legitimate claim on him, and the end might be that her son would be made heir to the best part of his estates. No son at that early age could promise to have more of his father's physique. But her becoming Grandcourt's wife was so far from being an extravagant notion of possibility that even Lush had entertained it, and had said that he would as soon bet on it as on any other likelihood with regard to his familiar companion. Lush, indeed, on inferring that Grandcourt had a preconception of using his residence at Diplow in order to win Miss Arrowpoint, had thought it well to fan that project, taking it as a tacit renunciation of the marriage with Mrs. Glasher, which had long been a mark for the hovering and wheeling of Grandcourt's caprice. But both prospects had been negatived by Gwendolyn's appearance on the scene, and it was natural enough for Mrs. Glasher to enter with eagerness into Lush's plan of hindering that new danger by setting up a barrier in the mind of the girl who was being sought as a bride. She entered into it with an eagerness which had passion in it as well as purpose, some of the stored up venom delivering itself in that way. After that, as he had heard from Lush of Gwendolyn's departure, and the probability that all danger from her was got rid of, but there had been no letter to tell her that the danger had returned and had become a certainty. as he had, since then written to Grand Court, as she did habitually, and he had been longer than usual in answering. She was inferring that he mightn't in coming to Gadsmere at the time, when he was actually on the way, and she was not without hope, what construction of another's mind is not strong wishing equal to, that a certain sickening from that frustrated courtship might dispose him to slip the more easily into the old track of intention. Grandcourt had two grave purposes in coming to Gadsmere. To convey the news of his approaching marriage in person, in order to make this first difficulty final, and to get from Lydia his mother's diamonds, which long ago he had confided to her, and wished her to wear. Her person suited diamonds, and made them look as if they were worth some of the money given for them. These particular diamonds were not mountains of light, they were mere peas and haricots for the ears, neck and hair, but they were worth some thousands, and Grandcourt necessarily wished to have them for his wife. Formerly when he had asked Lydia to put them into his keeping again, simply on the ground that they would be safer and ought to be deposited at the bank, as he had quietly but absolutely refused, declaring that they were quite safe, and at last had said, if you ever marry another woman I will give them up to her. Are you going to marry another woman? At that time Grandcourt had no motive which urged him to persist, and he had this grace in him, that the disposition to exercise power either by cowing or disappointing others or exciting in them a rage which they dared not express, a disposition which was active in him as other propensities became languid, had always been in abeyance before Lydia. A severe interpreter might say that the mere facts of their relation to each other, the melancholy position of this woman who depended on his will, made a standing banquet for his delight in dominating. But there was something else than this in his forbearance toward her. There was the surviving, though metamorphosed effect of the power as he had had over him. And it was this effect, the fitful dull lapse toward solicitations, that once had the zest now missing from life, which had again and again inclined him to espouse a familiar past, rather than rouse himself to the expectation of novelty. But now novelty had taken hold of him, and urged him to make the most of it. Mrs. Glasher was seated in the pleasant room, where she habitually passed her mornings with her children round her. It had a square projecting window, and looked on broad gravel and grass, sloping toward a little brook that entered the pool. The top of a low, black cabinet, the old oak table, the chairs in tawny leather, were littered with the children's toys, books and garden garments, at which a maternal lady in pastel looked down from the walls with smiling indulgence. The children were all there. The three girls, seated round their mother near the widow, were miniature portraits of her dark-eyed, delicate-featured brunettes with a rich bloom on their cheeks, their little nostrils and eyebrows singularly finished, as if they were tiny women, the eldest being barely 9. The boy was seated on the carpet at some distance, bending his blonde head over the animals from a Noah Ark, admonishing them separately in a voice of threatening command, and occasionally licking the spotted ones to see if the colors would hold. Josephine, the eldest, was having her French lesson, and the others, with their dolls on their laps, sat demurely enough for images of the Madonna. Mrs. Glasher's toilet had been made very carefully each day. Now she said to herself that Grandcourt might come in. Her head, which, spite of emaciation, had an ineffaceable beauty in the fine profile, crisp curves of hair, and clearly marked eyebrows, rose impressively above her bronze-colored silk and velvet, and the gold necklace which Grandcourt at first clasped round her neck years ago. Not that as he had any pleasure in her toilet, her chief thought of herself seen in the glass was, how changed, but such good in life as remained to her she would keep. If her chief wish were fulfilled, she could imagine herself getting the comeliness of a matron fit for the highest rank. The little faces beside her, almost exact reductions of her own, seemed to tell of the blooming curves which had once been where now was sunken pallor. But the children kissed the pale cheeks, and never found them deficient. That love was now the one end of her life. Suddenly Mrs. Glasher turned away her head from Josephine's book and listened. Hush, dear. I think someone is coming. Henley the boy jumped up and said, Mama, is it the miller with my donkey? He got no answer, and going up to his mama's knee repeated his question in an insistent tone. But the door opened, and the servant announced Mr. Grandcourt. Mrs. Glasher rose in some agitation. Henley frowned at him in disgust at his not being the miller, and the three little girls lifted up their dark eyes to him timidly. They had none of them any particular liking for this friend of Mama's. In fact, when he had taken Mrs. Glasher's hand, and then turned to put his other hand on Henley's head, that energetic scion began to beat the friend's arm away with his fists. The little girls submitted bashfully, to be patted under the chin and kissed, but on the whole it seemed better to send them into the garden, where they were presently dancing and chatting with the dogs on the gravel. How far are you come? Said Mrs. Glasher, as Grandcourt put away his hat and overcoat. From Diplo, he answered slowly, seating himself opposite her, and looking at her with an unnoting gaze which she noted. You are tired, then? No, I rested at the junction a hideous hole. These railway journeys are always a confounded bore. But I had coffee and smoked. Grandcourt drew out his handkerchief, rubbed his face, and in returning the handkerchief to his pocket looked at his cross knee and blameless boot, as if any stranger were opposite to him, instead of a woman quivering with a suspense which every word and look of his was to incline toward hope or dread. But he was really occupied with their interview, and what it was likely to include. Imagine the difference in rate of emotion between this woman whom the years had worn to a more conscious dependence and sharper eagerness, and this man whom they were dulling into a more neutral obstinacy. I expected to see you, it was so long since I had heard from you. I suppose the weeks seem longer at Gadsmere than they do at Diplo, said Mrs. Glasher. As he had a quick incisive way of speaking that seemed to go with her features, as the tone and timbre of a violin go with its form. Yes, drawled Grandcourt. Be but you found the money paid into the bank. Oh, yes, said Mrs. Glasher, curtly, tingling with impatience. All was before at least she fancied, so Grandcourt had taken more notice of her and the children than he did today. Yes, he resumed, playing with his whisker, and at first not looking at her, the time has gone on at rather a rattling pace with me. Generally it is slow enough. But there has been a good deal happening, as you know. Here he turned his eyes upon her. What do I know? Said she, sharply. He left a pause before he said, without change of manner, that I was thinking of marrying. You saw Miss Harleth? She told you that? The pale cheeks looked even paler, perhaps from the fierce brightness in the eyes above them. No, Lush told me, was the slow answer. It was as if the thumb screw and the iron boot were being placed by creeping hands within sight of the expectant victim. Good God, say at once that you are going to marry her, she burst out, passionately, her knees shaking and her hands tightly clasped. Of course, this kind of thing must happen sometime or other, Lydia, said he, really, now the thumb screw was on, not wishing to make the pain worse. You didn't always see the necessity. Perhaps not. I see it now. In those few undertoned words of Grandcourt's she felt as absolute a resistance, as if her thin fingers had been pushing at a fast-shut iron door. She knew her helplessness, and shrank from testing it by any appeal, shrank from crying in a dead ear and clinging to dead knees, only to see the immovable face and feel the rigid limbs. She did not weep nor speak. She was too hard-pressed by the sudden certainty which had as much of chill sickness in it as of thought and emotion. The defeated clutch of struggling hope gave her in these first moments a horrible sensation. At last she rose, with a spasmodic effort, and, unconscious of everything but her wretchedness, pressed her forehead against the hard, cold glass of the window. The children, playing on the gravel, took this as a sign that she wanted them, and, running forward, stood in front of her with their sweet faces upturned expectantly. This roused her. She shook her head at them, waved them off, and overcome with this painful exertion, sank back in the nearest chair. Grandcourt had risen too. He was doubly annoyed at the scene itself, and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.